lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. And I'm joined today with two of my co-hosts, both Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson, as well as Oklahoma Christian University political scientist, Trey Orndorff. The reason there are three of us this week, this wasn't what we had planned, actually. What's going on? Sort of a personal note. On Monday, my mom died, and I just wasn't in a position to do this week's show kind of as usual. And Trey immediately offered to take over for me this week, and I was happy to accept that that generous offer. But I still wanted to come on the show this week, even, you know, if in a smaller role than usual, because a couple of things. Number one, I thought it would be good for me to focus on something other than my mom's death for a little while. But also, I wanted to say a few words about my mom, because she, more than anyone else, kind of made me the person that I am. I went into her profession of teaching. She was a junior high school teacher in the Cleveland Public Schools for many years. And I share her love of, you know, dogs, books, politics, and the United States. And my mom was a really dedicated political junkie, though. We definitely didn't see eye to eye on politics. Fox News was always on wherever she was, and she absolutely loved Bill O'Reilly. So yeah, you can imagine. In her defense, she wasn't very fond of Donald Trump, though not too long after Donald Trump became president, her dementia kind of robbed her of the ability to follow politics. So she was a really special person, very lively, very opinionated, often very exasperating to me, but just so incredibly giving and loving. And I miss her and I love her very much. So I wanted to sort of say that and dedicate this show, I guess, to her. So Thank you for that, guys, letting me do that.
And Mike, we want to say, we're sorry for your loss. And I had the occasion to meet your mom a number of times, and she was really a fantastic and fun and smart. And as you said, lively lady. We're thinking of you and your family as we do this show.
Oh. Thanks. I appreciate that. Okay, so on to the matter at hand. Well, before we do get started, Trey and Jay will kind of be running the show here with me, just sort of jumping in to do some administrative things. But I wanted to remind folks, if you haven't yet taken that Politics Guys listener survey, we'd really appreciate it. We know some people have. It doesn't take that long, and the link will be in the show notes. It will really help us out, and it's all confidential, anonymous, not individually identifiable, all that stuff, and we don't share any of that with anyone. So today, we are going to be talking about a bunch of things: the Supreme Court and the vaccine mandate decisions, voting rights legislation, Joe Biden's big speech, and the big failure of that, given Senator Sinema's comments after that. What's going on with Ukraine and the Senate rejecting pipeline sanctions, the Republican National Committee's rejecting the Commission on Presidential Debates, the round, I don't know what it is, round 87 in Fauci versus Paul, and January 6th, Capitol insurrectionist rioters, call them what you will, who are running for Congress. So that's an awful lot. And what we do not get to on the free ad-supported part of the show, we will get to in the full show for our Patreon supporters. And please remember, if you're not a Patreon supporter, you can become one by going to patreon.com/politicsguys. You'll find the link in the show notes. And as always, if you don't have the ability to support the show financially but would like to get the full deal, I'm happy to help you out. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up with all of our content. All right. So with that, we will get started. But before we do, we'll just take a quick break and we will be right back. Okay, we are right back, and I will now turn things over to Trey to get us started.
Well, actually, Mike, I'll get us started.
Oh, to Jay.
Mike's a little, if Mike is not riding herd on all of us all the time, yeah, it's, there's all kinds of confusion. Our first story today is Thursday's Supreme Court decision or decisions staying implementation of the administration's large employer vaccine mandate. The court held in a 6-3 decision, unsigned 6-3 decision, that OSHA, that's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, lacked the authority to impose the mandate. To paraphrase the court briefly, this was not an everyday exercise of federal power, but instead a significant encroachment into the lives of a vast number of employees. The dissenters took the position that this was a rightful application of deference to an administrative agency, that I probably shouldn't use the word deference because that has a particular meaning, but that the matter was properly referred to OSHA, that OSHA has the expertise to make these decisions, and that the mandate should have been upheld. The other decision, which was a 5-4 majority, however, upheld the CMS mandate, the Center for Medicare Services, in relation to healthcare workers. And in that decision, Justice Roberts and Justice Gorsuch joined the court's liberals in upholding that. So this is a case we've discussed a number of times. Mike and I, we talked about it when the Fifth Circuit original stay came out, and then again when the Sixth Circuit undid the stay. This would seem to be, although it is still just a decision on a stay rather than, technically a decision on the merits, this would seem to be the last piece of it. So with that, I'll go to Trey and sort of get your thoughts on the decision and right or wrong from point of law and then right or wrong on policy.
Yeah, I mean, and I like that you said, I mean, we really got two different decisions here, and they're a little bit in conflict. It'll be interesting to see how, on the policy side at least, you know, how we decide to kind of play that out as we move forward. I think let's start with the OSHA, because that's going to be the far more broad and sweeping
much bigger
decision.
Yeah, issue.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I mean, or at least you were hinting at this, Jay. The court went beyond. I mean, it could have issued a much smaller opinion here, and you can see that in different kind of cases, and just agreed to this day and moved on. But instead, it seemed to actually kind of be, from my reading of it, to be hinting at the fact that it believes that effectively OSHA has gone past its power, and specifically what it's arguing here is that. The problem is that it's looking to, in the court's words, affect broad public health measures instead of working specifically more narrowly at what it calls, workplace hazards. And so they're saying there was this difference between the hazards of daily life, in the words of the court, and workplace hazards. And OSHA is only really authorized here to be dealing with the workplace hazards, not these larger hazards. And I think that's really where it's going to pin. And so the question becomes twofold. You have obviously some of these justices, I think, arguing that the delegation of power from Congress to the presidency has gone too far. That's one part of this. I think the other part is a question of whether or not OSHA has the right to have things that overlap. I think on that second point, that seems, I'm curious about your take on that, actually, Jay. It seems weird to me to put so much emphasis on that, given that all workplace hazards can also be broader hazards. So I was curious what you thought about that rule before we kind of, and then also the question of this delegation, because I see those as being the two key takeaways from the court in the case.
Yeah, so
I wanted to say before you jump in, Jay, I wanted to say that this is one of these rare issues where I think we all agree. I'm disappointed. In terms of policy, because you mentioned the politics or the matter of policy thing. And, I feel like as a matter of law that the court's absolutely right on this, that it goes beyond the OSHA's ability. But as a matter of policy, I think then, you know, I think the majority or in this case said that, well, you know, if you want to change this, you got to look to Congress, you got to look to the states. And so it's not to say that this wouldn't be a good thing. I think as a matter of policy, it would be a good thing, but that it's problematic in that Congress did not intend to give OSHA such broad authority. And if they wanted to, they certainly could have. And so that's where I think that, you know, we all agree on that. So,
yeah, the, you know, the other line the court cites or explains is that, you know, there's what's called the major questions doctrine. When we're talking about giving authority to administrative agencies, and the reasoning is that we expect Congress to speak clearly when authorizing an agency to exercise powers of vast economic and political significance. And that is the famous summation of that by Justice Scalia, was that Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes. That if you've got a significant power to regulate essentially not every worker in the country, although I think by implication you could say, well, if they draw the line at 100 or 99 or 35 or something like that, you know, the power is still there. There's nothing in the statute that would indicate that OSHA was created to deal with this large-scale issue that affects absolutely everyone in the country, regardless of their employment or not. So I think that's a big piece. And the other thing, if you just look at it the other way, is if this OSHA was empowered to demand that every employee in the country be vaccinated for COVID or foreseeably anything else, what's the limit then? And if we have a government of limited powers, and we have three branches, you know, what possibly could there be left for Congress to do, right? If an agency can issue these kind of vast and sweeping decisions without any political accountability. So I think the court absolutely got it right there. And they pointed out that if Congress wants to put in place this kind of mandate, it likely has the authority to do so. No, I think, like, look, if Congress were to pass a nationwide mandate or to specifically authorize OSHA to take the actions that it did, I think you'd still have pushback. I think you'd still have arguments. And I'm not saying that would be a 9-0 decision, but it's on a lot firmer ground.
I think, Jay, the reason why we know it wouldn't be 9-0 is because if you look at Biden versus Missouri, that second case, right, where it's very, very different, because HHS has for a long time issued rules about facilities that take part in Medicare and Medicaid programs about various things. And they made a very strong case specifically in terms of Medicaid for older people being more vulnerable to COVID. And yet there were four justices who said, no, that's not, you know, that's outside of their orbit. And so that's why I think that's pretty clear that would be in fact, I would hazard to guess that if Congress actually did act to do what the Biden administration tried to do through OSHA, that a majority on the court would say that does in fact exceed Congress's powers, even, I would guess.
I guess that's sort of hypothetical.
Because
it won't happen. I would disagree. Yeah. I think that probably gets upheld, although I think you have probably at least three dissenters. On say, like, you know, Commerce Clause grounds or general overbreath, underbreath, under-inclusivity, that sort of argument.
You know, on that, Jay, I just want to, one thing to point out, and this bugs me, is But people are dying is not a legal argument. And while I certainly have agreed that that's all horrific and tragic, the fact of the matter is even if Congress didn't act, states could act to protect people. And that would unquestionably be within the police powers of the states. There's no doubt in my mind that that would be upheld even by the Supreme Court, even though there would be legal challenges. So it's a question of it's not a question of nothing can be done. It's a question of, well, who are the proper actors to do that? And so if people are looking for a place to direct their rage and their anger, and I think understandably so in a lot of cases, I would say start with your state government, because traditionally state governments have the authority and have the responsibility in these police powers to protect citizens, residents in that state. And if they are failing on the job, that, I think, needs to be directed primarily toward them.
Well, I think this is where I'm so sorry, Jay, please finish your thought.
No, I was going to say, and there was a colloquy during oral argument between Justice Sotomayor and Ben Flowers, the state solicitor of Ohio, who I kind of know, Mike, actually. So, you know, six degrees, I'm just saying.
I feel like you're running for office there, Jay. I don't know.
No, I just wanted to say, hey, I know a guy who argued between this before the Supreme Court last week. her questions, and to some extent, I think her comments have been a little misportrayed in conservative media, right? That it came across as her not understanding that her question was Solicitor Flowers, do you think would the states have the power to enforce something like this? And he said, well, absolutely. Under the state's police power, states could put in a vaccine mandate. And then her follow-up was, well, what's the difference? And it was portrayed to some extent as like, what, Justice Sotomayor doesn't get the difference between state police powers and this. And I think what she was going for was to a certain extent, the court has already said, well, OSHA has its own sort of police powers as to a certain sphere of the world, right? And that is workplace stuff. So I think on the one hand, the colloquy I think was important because it did bring up that distinction that so often people who aren't into this kind of thing, right, aren't aware of that. Look, the powers of the state are different than the powers of the federal government, and also. In fairness to Justice Sotomayor, I hope she understands the difference. I think that wasn't exactly clear from the transcript.
Yeah. So I'd love, before we move on to our next story, I wanted to ask you guys on the policy grounds. I feel on the policy grounds that it would be good on policy grounds, both to have the overall mandate and to have the specific Medicare services facilities mandate. So I think that's right on policy. So taking the legal side, I'm wondering where you guys fall on that. Do you think that mandates, if they were, say, enacted, if a mandate were enacted in Oklahoma, my eyes practically rolled out of my head. But what do you think about that? If, say, in Oklahoma or Ohio, in our case, Jay and Trey, what do you think about the, would you support that or not? I wonder.
Well, I mean, I'll have to go first. I like thinking about the policy side, Mike, because I think in part, when we get into these stories like this, there's always this broader structure. I think one of the reasons why what's happening with the court is a disconnect is because we as a country have not thought as carefully about how we want the separation between congressional and executive powers to be. And right here, and Jay, I like you were talking about that. Same thing holds true in terms of federalism, right? So you talk about the policy side here, and I'm happy to weigh in on that. But of course, the potential problem with having doing the state-by-state mandate is that any particular, you get enough states that won't do it, and it kind of blows blows up your it blows up your outcome purpose. I think policy wise, when it comes to a matter of public health, it'd be great, but I don't think you could actually make it happen in the States. I mean, again, you're talking about rolling your eyes in your head, but here in Oklahoma, we're still fighting a battle over whether or not generals can command troops to get a mandate. Specifically, Oklahoma. So Governor Stitt of Oklahoma, for listeners who don't know, actually filed suit arguing that it was overreach, it was unconstitutional that generals command their soldiers, and that he would actually get a chance to veto what was happening on that front. Now, he's lost, but the fact that he took that position says to me that as a policy matter, that doesn't work out. And you know, we're going to talk about this in terms of voting legislation later on. I think the primary question becomes, on matters of policy, how comfortable are we going to be being in a singular system in which we have fundamentally very different answers to questions like, what do we do about vaccines? What do we do about voting?
Yeah, I would be comfortable in that system. But secondly, I guess more just to on the policy, assuming, you know, for example, in Ohio, that the state had the votes, which it does not. I still think it's a bad idea, just because I don't think it works. I don't think...
Which part doesn't work, Jay?
Mandates. If you're trying to mandate something that people have deep-held feelings about, deep-held fears or religious convictions or whatever. Now, those can be rational or irrational, and they can be right or they can be batshit crazy. But often, I think the fact that just the government tells you to do something... it doesn't override those other fears or fears, convictions, whatever you want to call them. And I think you've seen that a lot of places saying, listen, if I'm, you know, employee saying, look, if I'm forced to get a vaccine, I'll just quit. I think that's out there, or people, you know, are faking, you know, vaccination cards and so forth.
But isn't that just evidence?
I think there are better ways to do it. You know, carrots rather than sticks, perhaps.
But the government's not about carrots. It's all about sticks, right? You get fined if you go too fast. We get right. Like, I hear what you're saying there, Jay, but if we take that to its logical conclusion, then you need to be an anarchist. You need to come over my side. You need to be a libertarian, right? Like, if you're going to take the idea that we're going to have rules that carry penalties, and we all the time go up against people's deep-seated problems with particular issues. I mean,
how does it work? I mean, prohibition, right? You know,
I think there are. I mean, there certainly are a lot of sticks, but there are also a lot of carrots in the tax code. You know, I'm thinking about, Jay, a conversation we had a few weeks ago. I said, well, what about if there were, say, a $2,000 refundable tax credit for everyone who got vaccinated? And that would, you know, that would both be economic stimulus and, you know, also a way to.
Although that strikes me as pricey, but yes, go ahead.
But I mean, we've in terms of direct payments, we've already paid that out to a whole bunch the government has already. So I'm just pulling a number, you know, out of wherever. But I mean, so certainly I can understand, Trevor, in your libertarian soul, you believe that it seems like sometimes it's all sticks. There are an awful lot of carrots in the tax code. Now, I agree, I think, with you, Jay, to an extent where for some people, I don't think that the carrots could be made large enough.
Yeah.
The incentives could be made large enough to get some people to get vaccinated because it's become such an issue of just resistance. I would say almost for the sake of resistance, it's become so politicized. I mean, we've had, you know, people being discharged from the military because they refused. So giving up their military career because they refused to get vaccinated and that kind of thing. I don't think you overcome with a tax credit or a payment or anything like that. There's just that. Right. Even if there were a mandate.
By definition, you don't overcome it with the stick either. Unless you want to go to sticks, like if you don't get vaccinated, well, we'll put you in jail.
Well, so let me throw it out. I want to take that line of thought because I like in theory where we potentially head with that, but that means then let's stop regulating drugs, for example. We're never going to stop all the druggies. I mean, they're going to quit their jobs and they're going to, you know, smoke and they're going to do what they're going to do. So why overcome those beliefs? Heck, some of those, we even had a court case on it. There's religious convictions involved. So let's kill the drug laws. Right.
I mean, that's a lot of people say that, Trey. I mean, libertarians, right?
I know. I mean, that's my point. What I'm saying, though, is I want to get on board, but I'm not sure that everybody here would then. I mean, would you agree? I mean, would you be on board with that? I'm curious.
No, I wouldn't be on board with getting rid of all drug laws.
So then what's the distinction? I guess that's what I'm having trouble with sometimes when I'm hearing this debate is. I don't understand.
I don't think it has to be all or nothing. I mean, I don't think it has to be. You know, it's like when we're talking about drugs and zero tolerance. Well, you can have laws, but you can have laws and requirements, but there's always, and I think it's a good thing, some discretion in terms of how stringently they are going to be enforced. Because laws serve I can think of two purposes, which means there are probably half a dozen. But you know, one purpose obviously is to get people to do something and a mechanism of enforcement and punishment. Sort of thing, and that's certainly important. But laws also serve as a sense of where we are as a country, and they have a force outside of the actual legal system in terms of they're saying this is something we believe to be important, and this is something we are as a society say should be done. And you can have that without strict zero tolerance enforcement. And so that's kind of where I fall.
This is something that is sanctioned by society. This is something that is not.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So the point then is, why couldn't we have a vaccine mandate be something that we as society want to sanction and push forward? That's what I'm getting to, right? Like, my point is to say, like, if you're going to be okay on the one, I don't feel how you could be against potentially a mandate. That's you see, I'm getting that.
Well, a lot of it also goes, I guess, into what's going to be the penalty for it, right? If this is a get vaccinated or pay a $50 fine. That's one question. The other is get vaccinated or be unemployable.
I mean, that's other drug questions. If you can't pass a drug test, you are unemployable.
Yeah.
So wouldn't that be equivalent?
I mean, it's tough to find a happy medium, right? Because on the one hand, if the fine is so negligible, it just makes a joke out of it. Or if there's no kind of penalty, there's a law without a penalty, then the law is just, becomes a laughingstock in a way. But if the penalty, like you said, Jay, is, if you don't do this, we'll destroy your life, that would just create more resistance and be ineffective. So I don't know where that middle ground is, but I think certainly, I mean, I would prefer carrots to sticks, but I think oftentimes what we do is we have some combination thereof, where if you do this, we give you a little something. And if you don't, we make life a little more uncomfortable. And that maybe gets us to the vaccine. I mean, it doesn't get us to 100% vaccination, of course, but maybe that moves the needle a little bit. And I think it's, you know, if it's done thoughtfully, and that's always a big problem with some of these things, that certainly could make a real difference and save some lives and preserve the health of some people.
So, and I'm going to throw in just one more piece of why so often government mandates or government action in general is a blunt instrument, is the case as it came up to the Supreme Court. By the time it was argued, a lot of what we're already talking about, because of the Omicron variant, was already almost water under the bridge, right? Because if now we're living in a world where Omicron can infect people who have been vaccinated and boosted, and they can spread it. Now, it's good for those people. They're vaccinated and boosted. They have a much lower risk of any serious complications, and the infection will most likely be mild. But the idea that vaccination stops infections, that's just not the case anymore because of how the virus has evolved. And I think that you start getting into those kind of questions too, on how important is it to have a mandate. Well, if the idea is, listen, we're afraid that the unvaccinated will spread it to others, that's not really the case anymore, right? The vaccines, I think, and I'm sure there's science to show that if you're vaccinated, you're probably less likely to spread it. But it's fundamentally different, I think, than the numbers we were talking about, and the likelihood of infection and reinfection from COVID Classic and Delta.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and I mean you have to weigh both the transmission and the severity, and I think reasonable people can come to different conclusions about whether the coerciveness of a mandate outweighs the public health effects. I would tend to be, probably not surprisingly, right, a little more on the side of saying, well, I think that the mandate would, but I certainly understand the argument, and it's a legitimate one, and it's not an open and shut sort of thing, certainly. So I think that's a good point.
Yeah, and that to me goes to, look, the government's ability to react to these things in real time. And all the more reason why you know you're better off doing letting local governments or private sector actors sort this out for themselves.
So guys, we should probably move on, because I am eager to find out whether or not Jay, you and Trey are on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis. We'll get to that in a minute. But before we do that, we need to take just a quick break, and we will be right back. All right, so we are back, and so I was very curious about this. I know that we're going to be talking about voting rights legislation and ending the filibuster. And Trey, I think you're the one who wanted to kind of get us started on this, right?
Yeah, I mean, this, we get the, I don't know, this could be, is this maybe the turning point of all of history right here at this moment?
That's what they tell me, yes.
But be that as it may, right?
So Stacey Abrams couldn't make it.
Biden gives, I mean, probably the most divisive, and I want to start by saying that probably the most received different ways speech yet of his short presidency. On the one hand, Nancy Pelosi called the speech fabulous and wonderful. Meanwhile, though, even some of his own members, Dick Durbin, argued that he had gone a little too far. And specifically what he was arguing about was that it's time to have true voting rights legislation. He gives a speech in Georgia. Unfortunately, though, what he ties this to is that you're effectively either on the side of expanding voting rights or you're on the side of segregationists. And as soon as this gets done, he's coming back to the Hill to then push for the speech. And already he's already been undercut, because he's not going to be able to get I cannot speak today, gentlemen.
That's true.
There is here in Oklahoma today, I'll just be honest, it keeps throwing me for a loop. We've got 60-mile-an-hour winds, and so the roof of my building sounds like it's going to blow off at points, and it is throwing me for a loop. So if you listeners, you're wondering why it's a little different. The filibuster. He wants to get rid of the filibuster. It's dead on arrival before he even gets finished. He gets a floor. He gets a sideline. I'm going to kind of give a little bit of my takeaway here. I can't figure out why the Biden administration and Democrats at large think that they're going to get these big things done when they've got a 50-person Senate. I mean, even in the best of circumstances, take away the filibuster, the likelihood that they're going to get all these big pieces of legislation passed is low. They're setting themselves up terribly. I mean, if you're running a campaign, you never set your expectations so high when you don't think you have the ability to deliver. You set them much, much lower and you exceed. But instead, again and again, Biden here doesn't get it. Now, the good news is, I'd say, and I don't know, Jay, maybe you agree with me, I voted for Biden in part because I didn't think he'd be able to get a lot of things done, but he wouldn't be, crazy. And so I think on that front, I'm winning.
Which proposition there?
I mean, as we all knew, he's going to have a tight Senate. He hasn't gotten anything done. And this is just another example of Democrats aren't going to make big sweeping changes because they don't have the votes to do.
I understand what you're saying, but you're completely wrong on one point, is that, I mean, certainly he has gotten something huge done, something that Donald Trump said he would do and didn't manage to do, and that is a massive infrastructure bill. So now if you want to say aside from that, okay, fine, but aside from, a trillion plus, that's not nothing.
I guess what I was saying, though, was that there was this argument beforehand that if you weren't for Trump, you were going to get crazy. But of course, had you gotten Trump, the best you could have probably hoped for and not crazy would have been an infrastructure bill, right? Plus crazy.
But Mike, I mean, an infrastructure bill, albeit I can quibble about the size and the amount and how much is really infrastructure and all that. That wasn't a major partisan ideological piece. I mean, it was substantially bipartisan. And you had substantial bipartisan support for that even early on. Again, their arguments over the price tags or so sort, but most people would describe that as not the type of big overhauling federal voting rights or a Build Back Better, these big transformative type pieces that he's put out there.
Now, I will admit that I understand why he's frustrated. I get why I understand why Democrats want a voting rights bill. But there's no votes there to get it, unfortunately.
Well, I think we need to make some distinctions. There's a distinction between what the progressive wing of the Democratic Party wants, what Democrats identified Democrats want, and then what the American people want. And those are oftentimes very different things. For instance, on voting rights, I mean, there have been a bunch of surveys saying that a majority of people, oftentimes large majorities of people, including people of color, are okay for various voter ID laws. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's sad to me that a president who started his presidency with I pledge that I will be a president for all Americans, I guess, except the racists who are half the country, right? I mean, I mentioned the Bull Connor thing because in his speech in Georgia, right, he said, you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace, John Lewis or Bull Connor, Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis. And once again, he pulled out Jim Crow 2.0. And it just made me not just say kind of ugh, but also made me very disappointed because that downplays, that diminishes the awfulness of what Jim Crow was, comparing this to that. And the idea that you would do that, I think, is repugnant in a way. And I get why he's doing it, but that obviously doesn't make it the right thing to do. So I would say it was the wrong thing to do rhetorically. It was the wrong thing to do morally. And it was definitely the wrong thing to do politically, because you don't make a speech like that without making sure that very next day, the key senator you need comes up and says, oh, I can't do this. I mean,
there was more than one. I mean, you have two who come out outright. By my count, you don't have seven.
Yeah, but Sinema came out and Manchin kind of backed her on that. But it was Sinema. And so what I'm saying is that it is hard to put together something that's wrong on more levels or bad on more levels than what Joe Biden did this week. And so I just it's hard for me not to just I'm glad Donald Trump isn't president. But I got to say, this has been a pretty sad week for me in terms of the expectations of the president.
It reminded me of the words of a noted jurist, which I'll play for here.
Is what do you stand for, Danny? Goodness or badness?
That of course is Judge Smales from Caddyshack. I think his speech was to quote Mitch McConnell, deeply, deeply unpresidential. And really, I think the worst kind of race baiting demagoguery. And I've had this issue with Joe Biden for a while. When we talked about his acceptance speech last year, and I gave him high marks saying, look, this is great. He's going to be a unifier and president for everyone, and we're going to get away from this. But I also said, this is also the guy who told an NAACP audience they're going to have y'all back in chains. And there's no place for that in our rhetoric, because, as you said, it does demean what has gone before, and comparing modest changes in voting laws in places like Georgia and Texas, which are more open than states like Delaware, which are presumptively, I would say, unright. I mean, in the on the side of Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln, is ridiculous. It is that race baiting demagoguery, and he knows better. Right. I mean, this is not with Trump. You could even say, like, look, he's an idiot. He doesn't have the historical knowledge to even get what he's saying. But Biden ran on, hey, I'm institutional knowledge and I've been here for forever. And so I think that is really troubling. The other piece of this is just from the plain strategy of this, and I've said this a bunch of times, it's a really weird strategy of the left to say, you know, come up with this, vote for us, you racist morons. That's sort of the big talking point. And then they're surprised when, you know, these racist morons won't vote for us. I think really a whole lot of the country is tired of being called a racist morons. But there's a part of the Democratic base that absolutely eats it up.
Not morons.
There's two
just
things.
Racist.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think if you asked him to expand, I'm sure he'd include the moron piece. But I mean, this goes back to, I would say there's a, you know, direct link to the Hillary Clinton deplorable line, right? It's the same type of thing of like, oh my God, those people.
Just from a strategic standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense, certainly.
Yeah. And, you know, as Trey points out, you've got a 50-50 Senate.
Yes.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing that and Trey, you'll definitely appreciate that being a political scientist is that when you actually look at the political science research on, well, both vote suppression and vote fraud, what you find is that neither of these things have the effect or are problematic to the extent that they change elections or change outcomes. And that's not to say that either of them is okay, right? I'm not saying, well, a little bit of vote fraud.
Or that they couldn't someday in some elections.
Right. But there's an awful lot of research showing that a lot of voter ID laws really don't do anything significant to diminish turnout. And also that there's this article of faith for generations now at this point, I guess, that higher voter turnout helps Democrats and hurt Republicans. And there's plenty of research to show that that's actually not the case. There was a great article in National Affairs. It's a more conservative journal, just in their most recent issue, in fact, that kind of goes over this. And so a lot of what people are basing these positions on really isn't very well backed up by the actual evidence that we have. And, you know, I've talked about the vote fraud aspect of it a number of times. And so a lot of what people are fighting over, I think they don't really understand all that well. And that's never a good thing.
No, I mean, if you could redo Biden's speech, if he would have put me in charge, I mean, what he really needed to come out was he needed to have a continuation of the Jan 6 conversation and basically say, look, state legislatures are doing screwy things because they want to be able to do screwy things in a presidential election. And that's why we need to have, you know, voting change. Why he ties it to this race bait is beyond me.
The screwy things are always, and January 6th is always necessarily racist, racial, in the mind of the far left, right? January 6th was a white supremacist insurrection. That's sort of been the talking point for quite a while. And the other thing is if you take that route of, look, there's all this really screwy stuff going on in the states, I think at some point you run up against the plain language of these statutes, where Georgia and Texas allow more early voting than New York or Delaware. They allow excuse required absentee ballot voting. It's ridiculous. And if you even, Mike, you and I have talked about this a number of times that, listen, are there pieces of these various voting integrity acts, or if you want to call them voting restrictions acts, some are better than others. But there's a whole lot of it's just plain reasonable common sense, like voter ID, is that most people wouldn't object to. Things like, you know, the goofy is, you know, one of my pet peeves, that, well, I want to vote at 3 a.m. at a drive-through. These are just not substantially the same thing by any stretch of the imagination as Jim Crow. I think
we all agree.
Well, I mean, I, but the point to say, listen, there's something really screwy going on in these states, and we need immediate federal intervention. And this is a turning point in American history, and this is the biggest.
Well, I mean, so to take away just from the voting rights, I mean, the fact that we had the extensive, expensive desire to find voter fraud when clearly no voter fraud existed, and then to have legislation in response to that, I think that counts as a screwy thing. So, I mean, you take a look at Arizona, you take a look at Pennsylvania. Heck, even here in Oklahoma, the state went for Trump. I mean, there wasn't even close. And we still had petitions desiring that we investigate the IP addresses based on MyPillow guy's website. No joke, that was in fact the petition to the Secretary of State, despite the fact that we don't have anything connected to the internet. There's no IP addresses at all in Oklahoma, but the legislature still took that seriously and moved forward with it. I think that does count.
Is that a reason for federal intervention? If they're concerned about the states are spending too much money or not spending money wisely? I mean,
Sure, it is, because when everything is symbolic politics pulled away from any actual information or data or research, then, you know, why not? And that's to me.
No, so but I'm going back to the merits of the thing, right? On the merits, is there a reason for federal intervention? Is this as Joe Biden was, you know, sort of implying that American democracy is as good as dead if we don't get rid of the filibuster and pass these measures?
Yeah, and I agree with both you guys on this. I mean, I think certainly that what the states did was meritless. And so then what the federal government would do is, you could argue, meritless, or at least I don't want to be that strong about, but to say that is not the sort of significant thing that they are portraying it to be. And that's whether you're talking about vote protection, so-called legislation, or vote fraud prevention legislation. And so it has this performative aspect to it. But of course, that's where the anger and the energy and the money more than anything else is. And so you feel like you got to do these things. And my concern is that, okay, well, to this point, maybe research has shown that none of these measures really do much. Well, at what point does it ratchet up to the extent where there actually is an effect? And that's a legitimate concern. Now, I don't think we've seen that. Like, Jay, like you point out, I mean, New York has more restrictive voting laws than Georgia, I believe, in many respects. So yeah, a lot of this is just political theater.
They are on the side of Bull Connor and Jefferson Davis.
You know, and that's the problem with this rhetoric. When you keep on turning up the volume and turning up the intensity, eventually these measures may get to the point where they really start to have, you know, it develops a sort of momentum of its own. You're saying, well, fine, if that isn't enough, we'll do this. And the next thing you know, you have some real problematic things. And so I'm not saying that we shouldn't be concerned about this stuff, but I also think that a lot of it is less in terms of actual political electoral outcomes consequential. But the one thing that is consequential is, like, for instance, the Electoral Count Act. Jay, you and I talked about this, I think, in the last show. And hey, if Congress really wanted to do something and the administration really wanted to do something that they knew would have a difference that we could tell from recent history, right? What was January 6th about? I mean, a big part of it was that Electoral Count Act or the ramifications of it. So if they wanted to do something, they could do that. And I don't see a standalone bill that's being pushed on a bipartisan basis. And so shame on both parties for that. So there.
I thought for sure you were going to say something else, Mike. I'm so sorry that we.
are we all squarely? Well, you know, my last bit, and this is just a little weird personal privilege, because I read this and I'm debating whether, you know, I haven't verified it. It's just something I read in the media that John Meacham, a historian, assisted President Biden with the speech. In which case, I'm profoundly disappointed with Meacham. And I say that in the case, I mean, now that could be that the White House is just leaking this and saying, hey, don't blame us, Meacham wrote it, or it could have been a very much a case of Joe Biden calling up and saying, hey, what was the name of that guy who was in charge of the Confederacy again? You know, just, you know, trying to that type of very, very limited, you know, historical perspective putting on it. But Because that's the problem is the speech lacked absolutely any sort of historical perspective, and people get that. And eventually, when you keep running around calling it, there's a joke in conservative circles, and Mike, you've probably heard it. I think I've mentioned it before, and it's kind of funny because liberals just don't even get it. But the, you know, what do you call a conservative, or what do you call a conservative who's winning an argument? A racist.
Racist. Yeah.
And that's this was absolutely proof positive of. That's what you do. He was losing momentum with the bill, and rather than trying to scale back or do something different, he picked the, well, I'll call everybody racist. So.
Yeah. Well, and there's another level. I remember back when Donald Trump was president, and we would have conversations about the seemingly dumb moves, or we thought dumb moves on the surface, that Donald Trump made. You would kind of say, well, maybe he's playing 36 dimensional chess or something like that. And you can make that argument for Biden, saying that he knew this is a losing hand, but he also knows that he needs to kind of go in there and shore up the progressive side base and act like he's fighting for them, even though he knows the Senate well enough and has the institutional understanding to know that this isn't going to happen. And so he says this stuff that he doesn't mean, and it's not like he alienates anyone who he hadn't already alienated. I mean, his numbers are, his approval numbers are what they are, and they're better than Trump's, which is saying, nothing, basically.
Yeah, are they though? I mean, the last I saw there was one Quinnipiac put him at 33% approval rate. And the White House fired back and said, that's total BS. We're much closer to 43% approval rate.
I know right now, Biden is at, give or take, is it around in the low 40s, and Donald Trump was in the high 30s, like 37 or so at this point. So, an approval rating. So Trump, is pretty much a pretty low bar, though, to get over, essentially, I would say.
But again, keep in mind that Biden ran as a moderate uniting figure, right? His whole pitch was, I'm not going to be as polarizing as Donald Trump.
Just because I'm a data guy, if you take a look at the polls right now,
you
take a look at
morons.
The polls, he's at 42.2% as of Friday. His approval rating.
Yeah, and so a little bit better than Trump, but not saying. But I think to Biden, you mentioned, Jay, what he ran as, and I think that this is the problem when you elect somebody who seems like they wanted to be president because they wanted to be president forever, and that's sort of what they've done, and the goal is just to be president. And I never felt that Joe Biden particularly stood for anything aside from whatever happened to work in the Democratic Party. And so I guess I'm more comfortable with his sort of squishy lack of principles than what I saw as Donald Trump's principles, which were basically, abhorrent in many ways. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't prefer a more principled Democrat.
Here's one problem with that read, though, Mike, and that is that if you take a look at the probability of what's going to happen as he moves forward with this, he's setting up the possibility of a Trump return. So I can't completely let him off the hook for whatever the three dimension. I hate that. I hate thinking like whatever. It's just. But in all honesty, I don't understand this idea. Well, he can do this now, but if he ends up losing, I mean, the likely candidate's Trump.
Oh yeah, I just assume that's what's going to happen. Unless Donald Trump's health, prevents it. It's hard for me to. If I were betting, I would certainly bet on Donald Trump being the next president. Absolutely.
My point though then is you can't let Biden off. I mean, like, so the point being is one of the things that I want Biden to do is not screw up so bad that he can't beat Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. So I see what you're saying.
So let me just throw out one other funny thing. If the Biden thing is four dimensional chess or something, there was a funny sort of op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal by Douglas Schirn, who is Hillary Clinton's political press hack. Touting the virtues of a Clinton presidency or Clinton candidacy in 2024. So I think it's sort of He may have.
She lost to Trump, people.
Right. No, I know, but it's just one. It's the tireless efforts of Hillary Clinton. But second, the fact that now the folks, people are sort of saber rattling a little bit to the other side of Biden, right? It's not a matter of just appeasing the left base of his party. He may have I don't think it's a challenge. This was obviously one of those just, you know, goofy sort of trial balloon kind of things. But it shows that there's sort of agitation for someone who is more to the center than what Biden has been in practice.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, guys, before we move on, there are times like this where I sort of miss at least the idea of party elites in smoke-filled rooms just saying, well, this person will be. Now, there are obviously huge problems with that. But boy, when I think about what comes out of our presidential primary system, it's depressing as all hell. So
Biden
anyway,
Trump versus Clinton, part two, part three, part 17.
God, can I get Canadian citizenship? How would that work? Anyway,
it's surprisingly hard.
Yeah, I bet it should be. We come to the end of our free ad-supported segment of the show, and we'll be discussing all that other stuff I mentioned at the top on the full episode, and full episodes are ad-free. It generally run around 2 hours. They're available to our Patreon supporters, as well as anyone who isn't in a position to support the show financially, or if you just like to try out the full show before becoming a supporter on kind of a trial basis. Again, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us through Venmo. We're at politicsguys, as well as PayPal. All those links are in the show notes, as well as on politicsguys.com/support. And if you want to get that free access, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up. And once again, just a reminder, if you're not going to be with us for the rest of the full episode, if you could take our listener survey, we would really, really appreciate it. Only take a few minutes. Help us out a lot. And also, whether you're a supporter or not, if you could subscribe, rate the show, leave a review on the podcast app of your choice, that would be great. Thanks so much.